Our series in Ecclesiastes, I've simply entitled, What If? And today's sermon is entitled, The Great Equalizer. I'm fairly sure that I have shared a significant moment of childhood trauma that occurred to me long, long ago. At least I've shared it with some of you. It occurred during my kindergarten days under the tutelage of one Miss Klubine, who was my kindergarten teacher. Miss Klubine, in her vast experience, it was her first year of teaching actually, decided to contact my mother to inform her that I was clearly a child with some sort of mental retardation. Those were her words. Today, we would say that I was intellectually challenged or delayed. And I know some of you are bound to reply, well, that explains everything. Let's not get nasty, shall we? This news, of course, upset my mother to no end. And as you can imagine, she wanted to find out if this was really true. And so immediately a child psychiatrist was engaged through the school board to assess me. After a few sessions, the psychiatrist informed my parents that I was not intellectually challenged, despite what some people might still believe today. But rather, I was simply bored. And he was right. You see, kindergarten bored me. The activities that most kids my age enjoyed, like playing imaginative games such as grocery store or house or farming, I disliked intensely. While they engaged in play to help us learn to socialize, I wanted to learn my ABCs and 1, 2, 3s. One thing about me that I readily admit is that I get bored very easily. I always have. As a kid, I was the one in the classroom looking out the window, daydreaming about all kinds of things. I would, in my mind, in the middle of a school lesson, create intricate stories of grand adventures. Now, I still do that, actually, occasionally. And I also find myself imagining myself in the heart of a story that I'm reading or watching on television or maybe a movie. Boredom in students is something that teachers try to cope with all the time. Boredom in parishioners is something preachers try to cope with all the time. Being bored drives us to do all kinds of things. Sometimes when we're bored, we do good things, like we create something. But sometimes boredom is destructive or leads to destructive things like vandalism. One odd thing that has come about in recent years is the understanding that being overly stimulated or being overly exposed to something actually leads to more boredom. According to the Center of Media Education, most children in North America watch, on average, 3 to 4 hours a day of television, or approximately 28 hours a week. Watching television is the number one after-school activity for those children aged 6 to 17 years. Each year, children spend 1,500 hours in front of a television, but only 900 in a classroom. And I suspect that during the pandemic, the numbers are even more skewed. By age 70, most of us would have watched 10 years of television. By age 21, the average viewer has seen 1 million commercials. Teenagers will have seen 100,000 alcohol commercials before they've even reached the legal drinking age. And children who watch 4 or more hours of TV a day spend less time, obviously, on schoolwork. They have poor reading skills. They play and socialize poorly with their peers. And they also have fewer hobbies. We are so overstimulated as a society through music and television and movies and the internet and video games that everyone is going around all hyped up, tense, and thus easily bored. Rediscovering our imaginations and our creativity plays a big part in our personal sense of happiness and contentment. One of the big lessons the preacher in Ecclesiastes is trying to teach us is that there's a difference between living and simply existing. And part of our journey is discovering that difference, is recognizing which philosophy of life we follow. Now, God's philosophy, if you will, or way of life, has many facets. But today's passage focuses on three specific ones. We might refer to these as three things to remember to find contentment in life. The first thing we need to remember is in verses 7 to 10. And that is that we can control things in our lives, at least some things. Namely, the big thing that you and I control is how we approach life. It is our attitude. We can live as if we are victimized by life, and therefore we can just go through life living passively. In other words, we can simply give up trying to find any good in this life. The preacher goes on to make some suggestions to recover our zest for life. In verse 7, he commends us to enjoy the very simple pleasures of life. We should cultivate fun and joy and humor. Too often in life, we chase after the big things, thinking that our lives will be happy and well-adjusted if we just simply get the big picture or the big ticket items. Many young adults, and honestly, I think I fell into this camp, think that if they just get a career and get married and have a family and buy a house, that everything will be okay. And now some of us who have been around for a little while, we just kind of giggle at that naivety. Achieving these things is no guarantee of happiness. The preacher tells us to intentionally find pleasure in the simple things of life. Things like good food and drink. He could add to that list by saying we should stop and smell the roses. Happy people are often the ones who find pleasure in the routine and the mundane activities of life. How long has it been since you have taken a moment to enjoy the world around you? The preacher suggests in verse 8 that we should make every day a party. The famous chef Imero has a cookbook actually by that title, but the preacher was the one who suggested it first. Even a regular day can become a special one if we dress up, put on our perfume, style our hair, and make it an occasion. The late Irma Bombeck was a great one at doling out nuggets of perspective on the simplest of things in life. She wrote a list of things she would have done differently if she were to live her life over again. And it adds some meaning to it when you realize that she wrote it just after learning she had terminal cancer. These are some of the things she said. I would have gone to bed when I was sick, instead of pretending the earth would go into a holding pattern if I weren't there for a day. I would have burned the pink candle sculpted like a rose before it melted in storage. I would have talked less and listened more. I would have invited friends over for dinner, even if the carpet was stained and the sofa was faded. I would have eaten the popcorn in the good living room and worried less about the dirt when someone wanted to light a fire in the fireplace. I would have taken time to listen to my grandfather ramble on about his youth. I would never have insisted the car windows be rolled up on a summer day, lest my hair that has just been teased and sprayed get messed up. I would have sat on the lawn with my children and worried less about grass stains. I would have cried less and laughed less while watching television and more while watching life. I would never have bought anything just because it was practical, wouldn't show soil, or was guaranteed to last a lifetime. Instead of wishing away 9 months of pregnancy, I'd have cherished every moment and realized that the wonderment growing inside of me was the only chance in life to assist God in a miracle. When my kids kissed me impetuously, I would never have said later, "Now get washed up for dinner." There would have been more "I love yous," more "I'm sorry's," but mostly, given another shot at life, I would seize every moment, look at it and really see it, live it and never give it back. How do we literally live life always clothed in our best? The Hebrew here means literally clothed in white, because white was the color of festivity. Especially when we remember the words of Ecclesiastes 7 verse 2. It is better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of every man. The living should take this to heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to heed a wise man's rebuke than listen to the song of fools. So how do we reconcile then these two pictures? Well, first, Ecclesiastes is an example of wisdom literature. And wisdom literature uses a literary tactic of placing two contrasting ideas together to try and get us to think and to ponder the deep things of life. Jesus used this brilliantly in his Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are they that mourn. It's also translated, happy are they that mourn. The answer to this puzzle is covered back in chapter 3. There's a time to weep and there's a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. The preacher's point is simply this. God wants us to experience the full spectrum of what it means to be human. We should not avoid going to the house of mourning, and we should try to make other days, days of celebration. What we should never do is go through life oblivious to what's going on around us, or allow our attitudes to be influenced solely by the winds of life that are blowing around us. We can control whether or not we see life as full of wonder and enthusiasm. Another thing that we can control is whether or not our marriages are a source of joy. That's in verse 9. All of us who've been married for a while know that marriage often begins with a few months of great excitement, only to morph into something more predictable. John Paul Getty was one of the richest men that ever lived on this planet. You would never expect someone like him to be envious of anyone. But Getty claimed he was envious of one group of people. Getty once remarked that he was envious of those who could make a marriage work. Getty himself was married and he was divorced 5 times. Maybe I'm stating the obvious, but getting married is not the same as enjoying a life with your spouse. Healthy marriages should allow flexibility for each individual to explore their own interests and hobbies. Yes, it's good to share some interests, but even if we are married, we are still individuals. So in my case, it's okay if Laura wants to watch Survivor or curling, especially now that we can PVR it. Good marriages take effort. It takes effort to not just get through life together, but to enjoy life together. This is especially critical for a couple that is going through its years and the children are gone and as retirement approaches. How do you enjoy life now in an empty nest? Finally, the preacher says that the one thing you can control is how you do things in life. So he suggests that we should do things with enthusiasm. We should put our hearts into whatever we are doing. The next thing we must remember in life is that whatever control we have, of course, is limited. None of us likes the unpredictability of life, but controlling people are truly miserable. As we have examined in length in this series, life is not fair. There's an old saying, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. There are always in our lives wild cards, always. There's always a monkey wrench just waiting to be tossed into our best laid plans. Notice the illustration that the preacher uses here. It's a very useful one. The fastest runner does not always win the race, and the strongest warrior every battle. In sports, we all know of stories of underdogs beating the favorites. At a horse race, they give odds on who is likely to win a particular race. Most often, they are fairly correct, but every once in a while, the long shot wins. Just ask the Philistines what the odds were that little David and his sling could bring down mighty Goliath. Now, we all know this to be true, but we try to manipulate or mitigate the risks in life with things like insurance and savings and wills, etc. But the very best preparation we can make is to consciously remember that our control is limited and that we all desperately need God. When tough times come, we always have a choice: go through them with God or without Him. Finally, the preacher wants us to remember in verses 13 to 18 that substance is always more important than image. Now, there's a historical example of how wisdom saved an entire city. Alexander the Great was marching his troops to the city of Lampsacus. As they approached the city, Alexander's old tutor, Anaximenes, came out to meet him. Alexander knew that his old teacher would try and talk him out of destroying the city, and so he vowed before his troops that he would not grant anything that Anaximenes had asked him for. Well, Anaximenes thought about it for a moment and then said to Alexander, "I desire of you that you will destroy the city." Well, Alexander had made an oath that he wouldn't do anything Anaximenes had asked him for. And so the city was spared. You see, here was a wise king that no one remembers. But he was a man of substance. He confronted a king who was all about image and glory and wealth. The battle between substance and image is still raging all around us. The current U.S. elections, or the previous U.S. elections, is a prime example of this. In the Toronto Star on October the 26th, there was an article that detailed 37 false things that Donald Trump reported as facts in one day. One day. Yet millions of people still intended to vote for him. Image over substance. The election that just happened reveals that feeling something to be true now supersedes something actually being true. And churches and ministries are not immune to this trend. Millions worldwide are attracted to churches that have a lot of glitz. They have Hollywood productions or emotional manipulation. The hard truth of Jesus is often downplayed, or Jesus is portrayed as holding a particular political view that really is not in line with the biblical view of Jesus. You see, God sees us differently than the world sees us. He sees beneath the facade to what is truly important. In the Bible, King Saul is portrayed as a man who looked like a king. He was tall and he was handsome, he was powerful, he was a bit egotistical too. But what did God say to Samuel? "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him." The Lord does not look at the things that man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at our hearts. But David, the youngest son of Jesse, a shepherd boy, was the king that was after God's own heart. Being popular, selling lots of books, going on a nationwide tour does not necessarily mean that someone is close to God. Many of those in the Bible who were closest to God led very difficult lives. The prophets, the apostles, and of course Jesus himself. We need to be very cautious in gravitating towards image and away from substance. As a pastor, one of my responsibilities is to keep my focus on the substance of faith, to not get suckered into playing religion. One of the surest signs of a drift away from substance is our desire to feel something religious rather than to wrestle with the truth of God. If we would rather feel good about God rather than squirm in our seats at his convicting truth, then we have come seeking image over substance. So again, the difference between living and existing comes down to your view of life, your philosophy of life. We must remember that we can control some things. We must remember that our control is limited and that substance is more important than image. To truly enjoy life as God provided it for us, even in all its ups and downs, this is true wisdom.